and roll. We got Richard C. Wilson and Andy McMullen, my partners in different capacities on the Capital Raiser show for the Build Your Legacy webinar investment series, which we are actually live streaming on Facebook today. So this should be a lot of fun. We're going to be admitting some people today, and we have a lot of stuff to cover, especially the stuff that we got going on in this book, Capital Raising. By the way, you can get a free copy at capitalraising.com. So with that, let's introduce the man, the myth, the legend, the Pope of Capital Raising, Richard Wilson, man. How you doing, my friend?
Doing good, Ruben. How you doing today?
I'm excited. So as usual, I'm all jacked up on Rockstar Energy drink, the orange hydration. So with that, let's introduce you, man. How did you get into this thing called capital raising and gear this specifically not to the family office, but for the scaling capital raiser and multifamily syndicator as they grow in their space?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I started five businesses before I got out of high school. And the first time I had to raise capital was just getting $700 from my dad to join a network marketing company when I was like 14 years old. And I cold called everybody at my high school's parents in the phone book and tried to sell them long distance telephone service. I think I sold like two people on it. But later on, I raised capital during college for an angel investment like tech company. And then I worked full time as a placement agent raising capital for hedge funds. But I grew up around my dad raising over $1 billion for nonprofits like hospitals, universities, and such. And so I'd go to meetings with him and drive him to meetings and learn that way as well. So it's been 15 years since I started Family Office Club, but you know, I've been around capital raising for a lot of my life.
Rock and roll. So you have effectively, at least according to this book, which was written many years ago, you've raised over $1 billion, or is that just the assets? I mean, which one is it? Have you raised $1 billion or have you acquired $1 billion or a portion?
I think we've probably completed somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion worth of deals. And it depends how you count it, right? Through our community, I'm sure billions of dollars of deals have gotten done, because just this year, our close at hand clients have closed on $83 million worth of transactions so far just this year. And we've been doing this for 15 years. But we don't like to throw out too huge of numbers. You see people on Facebook saying, oh, we've got $3 trillion in the room or something ridiculous. And right. You're just kind of like, all right, what does that really mean? You know, so we're always a little bit conservative on trying to talk about such things. But this year we're at 83 million so far.
Fantastic. Andy, do a quick intro, please.
Yeah. So I've been in this game about 20 years. Started, actually, I didn't have the pops to show me the ropes. He was a hoops coach, but he did teach me a lot about discipline, a lot about business and mindset. But, you know, we're focusing a lot more on multifamily built to rent projects at this point. We did quite a few deals in the last 3 years on those projects. And, you know, obviously we'll get a chance to talk about that more, but let's dig into Richard. I want to know what gives him the gumption, like the gumption to run all these businesses. He's got like, you know, he's doing the club. I heard about his goals this year. You know, I want to get into all this because I think it will help a lot of our community about how does one even start to believe that they can do this, because it's not easy. I talk to people in real estate and they say, real estate's so much more fun than I thought, and it's so much harder than I thought, right? And so I just love to hear, like, you know, where do you get the cojones?
Well, to say I get it from my mama, or I got it from my dad raising capital, I don't know what the right answer is there. But what we decided early on is that I would specialize myself and our value to ultra wealthy investors. And then no matter how long it would take to be a leader in the family office space, we would do whatever it took to be in the top position. So it's been 15 years growing Family Office Club. We bought familyoffices.com early on. Written 13 books now. We wrote one of the first books on single family offices, the only book on centimillionaires, the only book on how to start a family office. And now we're starting that whole 15-year path over again, buying billionaires.com, which we bought last year. And last week, we interviewed Mark Cuban, and he ignored my first 14 emails, including saying his favorite quote, no balls, no babies, in the subject line. He ignored that email. But my final attempt last week was a subject line that says balls equals babies, ? And he finally replied and answered my dang interview questions. So you'll see him on the homepage of billionaires.com. And, you know, we like to hang out with great people and just have a really long-term view on things, you know?
I know you got a lot of content to get through, but can I just ask one more question real quick?
Go ahead.
So, you know, I think like a lot of people on this call, or most people, don't have that same kind of access to billionaires. And I think a lot of people would say, oh, they were probably privileged. You know, they were born on third base, thought they hit a triple, whatever the, you know, you hear all of the lot. So what would you say in your experience in dealing with them, maybe just like two or three lines, like what are some of the through lines for those guys? And I even read that you're not going to read one single book this year, right? That wasn't either written by a billionaire, white paper, book, et cetera. So it seems like you just kind of studied the mind of this billionaire. So just quickly, because Ruben's got a lot of stuff he wants to ask, but I'm curious about that.
I started this business with zero access, less access than anyone has here on the Zoom. I had negative money in my bank account, basically, because I owed more for rent in my 300 square foot studio apartment in Harvard Square than I had less money in my bank account I owed for rent that month. And so I started with absolutely nothing and just used thought leadership to build things up, to attract people to me, exactly like Ruben and you are doing right here. I think one of the most important things is to realize that the billionaires have ridiculous work ethic and they're talented and skilled and are focused on their biggest strengths. So they're focused in an area that's smart based on their DNA, but they're also big work ethic. And then the other thing is that sometimes people come off as overly harsh because it makes for a nice dramatic TV show. But a lot of being very successful is building an amazing team and then treating them very well and treating your clients very well. And then people go out of their way to help you. And that was one of Mark Cuban's points, is that you need to go out of your way to be nice to people and not be harsh and overly competitive. And Jeff Hoffman had half of our room crying last year as a billionaire keynote speaker at our event. And he talked about how it's nothing shameful to be a white male who's super, super rich. It's just shameful if you don't do anything positive with your money. And so he talks about, what's the real motivation for my head of sales? Oh, it's his mother lives in an RV still, and that's where he grew up. So he helped his head of sales buy his mother a house and was there when he walked the mother into the house that they bought for his salesperson's mom.
Wow, fire. All right, cool, guys. So Capital Raiser Show Season 3, now brought to you by Pitch Decks, another one of Richard's companies. Hey, Matt, so you decided, actually, real quick. So we did a show, an episode, the season premiere of Season 3, which was all about Richard's business, about writing a book, about launching a conference, about a lot of things. And what we didn't really actually cover was capital raising, and this is why we invited him back. For the purpose of today, the only thing, we're not going to cover how to launch your own conference or any of that stuff. We're only going to talk about capital raising today. But I do want to ask you real quick, why did you want to become 50% owner of the Capital Raiser Show? I'm curious about this.
Well, one, Ruben, is that I want to compliment what my strengths are with people that have other strengths. And you're like super upbeat, high energy, positive, fun guy. I'm kind of introvert. You know, I kind of like hide behind things and answer my emails and negotiate deals behind a screen. And so I like that about you. And you seem like an honest, great person to work with. And it doesn't hurt that you have over a million downloads to your show. And the thing is, I run Family Office Podcast, and I've thought to myself many times, should I start another podcast? But it's so much work to do a decent job at one podcast that I said, no, I'll stay in my lane and let me just support Ruben and help him go faster down his lane. So it seemed like a really great fit in those reasons.
Yeah, 1.2 million downloads as we stand today. It is November 9th and we already have 30,000, 35,000 or so downloads just this month. So we might be on track to hit 100,000 for our first month that we've hit that ever this month. So we'll see how that goes. Awesome. I'm not sure with Thanksgiving if that's going to throw a monkey wrench into this. But hey, I wanted to go over some topics from the book, Capital Raising. I'm going to list off 9 different misconceptions and assumptions, which I was reading just last night, and I thought they were very powerful, and I would love for the audience to hear these. And then you can address one or two of these, but not all 9. Okay, so You need to hire people who have a database of first name relationships to raise capital. Wrong assumption. If you build, they will come. Wrong assumption. Not dedicating any resources to capital raising. Error. Completely missing the mark on authority positioning, educational forms of marketing, and improving their own pedigree standard in the market. Error. A complete lack of capital raising training. Error. You need to maximize outgoing phone calls and touches at all cost. Wrong assumption. You have a 3-month capital raising goal. You're not focused on medium to long-term. Error. Underestimating the value of being on a first name basis with your investors. Error. And spending $4K on a website, but spending zero on hiring an expert at copywriting marketing for positioning yourself in the marketplace error. Tell me, you know, any of these you think that you would want to cover for the audience today about, you know, which one is the worst misconception or assumption that they need to address as they're scaling and burgeoning capital raisers in the space?
Sure. Yeah. The number one that's connected to three or four of those is not spending enough energy on positioning yourself as an authority in the space, knowing your competitors, knowing what your ideal investors want, and then knowing that what you're putting out there is different and very compelling in two or three ways than all of your competitors, and compelling in a way that's dialed in exactly to your investor. And the way you communicate that should be done using a sense of authority and positioning. So you are the expert on stem cell investments for anyone living in Texas, or you are the expert for litigation hedge funds or the niche of real estate you're in within your region. So you just have to reverse the flow. In people's mind, they're often reaching out to investors cold and wondering why they don't get back to them. The only time you should reach out to somebody is when you have a really clear way of how you're going to add a ton of value to them so that they'll respond out of their own self-interest. Otherwise, you just should reverse the flow and have leads coming into you. So people are asking for your help to solve a headache that you are particularly well-built to solve. So just getting leads to come towards you because of your authority position is the best way to do it.
All right, let's knock out some of the chapters in this book. So you have five chapters in here, plus the introduction. Chapter one, analyze. Chapter two, position. Chapter three, architect. Chapter four, execute. And chapter five, iterate. Out of the capital raising book at, you can find for free at capitalraising.com. So let's break down analyze. So it is only through understanding how others have raised hundreds of millions that you can develop a high conviction capital raising strategy. When I was reading this, man, it really feels like this is written for or of the style of an MBA student, because it really goes into kind of like SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, oppositions, and threats. But let's just break down analyze. And it's crazy that you fit like a 500 page book in this 90 page pamphlet. It's very thin. You can read it in a day, probably in a couple hours, or maybe even less than that, depending on how fast you read. Tell us about analyze. What do we need to know there?
So positioning is the most powerful thing you can do. Architecting, you have to do, or you won't have defense around your positioning. It'll be worthless. But without the analysis, you're just going to position in the wrong place. You might be like, oh, we're going to do this really exciting thing and position ourselves uniquely in this way. Not only may people not care about the position you chose, it may actually hurt you. If you don't know what competitors are doing, you don't know who's raising capital the fastest, you don't know what is hurting others' capital raising or your own, and you don't know what investor you're targeting, and you don't know what your targeted investor set is complaining about and wanting, then you're just randomly throwing darts and be like, oh, let's try this position. And the average investment firm out there has some name like Wilson Capital, and nobody knows if you invest in biotech companies or pig farms, and then they're not attracted to you based on your brand name. The average company out there has no one-liner saying what you do in a concise single statement that nobody else can say. And these things cost absolutely nothing. There's no excuse like, oh, we're early stage, or, oh, we already printed $9 of business cards, so we can't change our brand. We know someone who had $8 billion in assets. They rebranded their whole company. Now they're at $22 billion. So at $8 billion, if you can rebrand, if you've got a really bad company name and no one knows what you do by reading it, you can rebrand as well.
Okay, cool.
Let me ask you real quick. On that point, I'm always curious about the kind of like iteration, the process. So at one point you had this position that you decided this is where we're going to stand. And I know because you built multiple businesses that that's kind of changed over time. Can you talk about maybe how that evolved just a little bit? Because I think most of us have some position, or we think is a position, might not be working. I imagine there was some inflection point for you or some breakthrough where you're like, oh yeah, I'm not really just this guy, but I can position myself in this. So maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a really great question that almost nobody asks. But I realized when I was invited at age 25 to speak on the same stage as two prime ministers in Belgium, and they paid me to fly over there and speak there. And I probably walked in, they said, who's this kid? Or like, who's this person who's lost, right? I realized, oh, and then everybody at that event and an event in Monaco I spoke at 2 months later referred to me as the hedge fund blogger guy. Like, oh, you're that hedge fund blogger guy. I'm a subscriber. I'm on your email list. And everyone would refer to me as the hedge fund blogger guy. I realized the only reason they had me speak is because I had put out 400 blog posts on capital raising, hedge funds, and family offices. And everyone, I was like, oh, I kind of created this position of like hedge fund blogger guy. And I don't know if I want to be known as that the rest of my life. So I can create whatever position I want. If I want to be the expert on prosthetic pinkies, or I want to be the expert on family offices, or whatever the niche is, just define that niche topic and audience, and then put out, you know, it's simple, but it takes a lot of hard work, you know, 500 pieces of valuable content on that one little tiny niche. And no one else will want to do that work. And you find a place that has a little bit of a void. So you're not fighting against 1,000 other people that are doing the exact same authority positioning strategy. But then you can design whatever positioning you want. So I see it as one big funnel. We have the Family Office Club funnel. Within that is a little funnel of how to start a family office, a funnel on working with single family offices, a funnel when we bought centimillionaires.com and wrote Centimillionaire Strategy Book for $100 million net worth families, and a funnel for billionaires.com. It's all part of the Family Office Club funnel. So we're not abandoning our core business. It's just a funnel within a funnel. And it all leads into, you know, Disney World. There's just different doorways to come into Disney World into our funnel.
Good stuff.
Fantastic. All right. So back on the topic of books, you and I are going to be writing a capital raising strategies book. So really excited about that. I was hoping that I could lock you down to a date when we write this live here on Facebook. So what do you think about that, Richard?
Nice. Yeah, I think we should set a date. I mean, you tell me, when do you want to knock this out? Do you want to get something done Q1 by April? I mean, what's your goal?
I'd like to get it done. So here's number one question. I'd like to do it before the end of this year at the latest January. How about this? Sure. Worst case scenario, by my birthday, January 21st of next year. So I would like to start writing this a little bit sooner. And we have all the content, dude. I've done like 240 plus episodes of just direct interviews, plus 60 special series, including the Build Your Legacy episodes. We have 500 and probably close to 580 pieces of content that have been released on the Capital Raiser Show, which is one of the reasons we have so many downloads, is because there's so much content that's a lot, you know, that you can download. But yeah, I'd like to lock you down on a date. So I would say, what is your availability? Because I know you have this crazy, giant, massive summit coming up in Miami that you guys can check out at familyoffices.com. And next year, there's going to be like, how many events are you doing next year? Like 20?
15 live events a year.
15 live events. Anything outside of the country, going back to Singapore or Europe or anything, or is it all going
to
be US?
We will go to Singapore next. Last time we went there, we were at the Raffles Hotel. So we'll put that on our website once we get it booked. But we're making sure our events in the US are twice as big next year, twice as long, aiming for 75 plus speakers on stage over 2-day events and cocktails the night before. And our Super Summit, we'll have 150 speakers on stage this December. But yeah, let's get the book done by our birthday. I mean, at this point, we've got about 25 people on the team, and we can help architect the content, and it'll be a lot of my team knocking out some of the nitty gritty stuff once you and I know what we want to do, right? So I'm mostly putting my team on the spot more than myself. So I'm happy to do that.
What's the time frame it usually takes you to write a book? I know you've done 13 so far. How long did it take you to write this book, for example? Because it looked like you were getting ready to meet with a big investor right before, as you even say so in the book, that you're writing it right before meeting with an investor. It sounds like you did it immediately or very quickly.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I'll architect the outline of the book. And then for a book like that, it might take me between 3 and 6 months to get it out. But I wrote one book on a red eye flight from New York City to the West Coast to Portland, Oregon. And I wrote the whole book with some coffee on that one flight. And then I just edited the book and it was done. But I'd been thinking about the book for a long time. And that's the key. I think that if you have never written a book before, after 13 times doing it, the most important lesson I've learned is just create a PowerPoint presentation with 13 slides. On every slide, have a case study, a story, insights, a best practice, something to avoid. And then have those 13 different ideas, and those can be the chapters of your book. And if you give a webinar or a public talk and you do it 6 times, it's going to get better and better. And by the 6th time you do it, just record it and transcribe it at rev.com. And then that transcription can be the draft for your book. And then you can get a thin book out. Nobody likes to read really thick books if they read at all. They like Audible better. So have every book on Audible. Don't write books this thick. Write them like the Capital Raising book you see there, or our Centimillionaires book, super thin. People like to spend 1 hour, get the main point. If you want to go deeper, you link to a webinar, a video, podcast episode, and get them engaging with you and your website and reaching out to you. So that'd be some advice for people trying to get their first book done.
All right. What would you say are the first steps? Because I'm about to launch my own capital raising coaching program. What would you say if you were a coach the people need to start doing or implementing or understanding, because this is a medium to long-term game, you know, as they start to get into capital raising, what do they need to know? How can they start making money the fastest, even though it is a medium to long-term game?
Right. Warren Buffett says that sometimes the tide matters more than the swimmer. So you can be Michael Phelps, but if you're swimming up the Amazon River, you might not move. And if you're along with the trends that are going on and what investors want, then you're going to raise a lot more capital. So I would look at where the trends are. Where is there a ton of demand right now? Where is there a ton of interest? And don't fight the trend. I would also associate with the best quality, most honest, most trustworthy team possible. And you really just love the team. You enjoy working with them. And you know they're always going to do the right thing by you by working with them. That's super important, so you don't waste all of your time. And then also, you want pieces of your model to sweat for you and not just sit there, right? So your investment structure, if you go to an attorney and say, oh, well, I don't know what structure to use. What should I use? They may say, oh, well, everybody does this. That's the best practice. So please use that. Well, they make a lot more money just by stamping out template legal docs and then charging you $12,000 or $40,000. They don't make a lot of extra money. They make a lot less money if they custom structure something for you that's different than everyone else they serve and even better for investors and even better for you. They don't make more money that way. And so their advice is not going to be what's in your best interest. And you can have an investment structure that sweats for you and helps sell your investment, or just an average investment structure. And you can have a brand like Wilson Capital that means nothing, or a brand like investorresidences.com or something that's very functional and says what you do and leads people to know what you do and want to work with you. So those are some real kind of 101 capital raising things just to take note of.
All right. So talk to us about building authority or creating a presence so people can find you and see you as a credible source for investments.
Sure. So what you want to do is identify what is the sandbox that you want to dominate. Are you buying dry cleaners in Austin? Are you buying self-storage in Orlando? What is the sandbox that's tight enough that you could be a top three, hopefully number one in that sandbox, but is a big enough sandbox that if you ever dominated that, it would be amazingly valuable. It's usually best to start out with a smaller sandbox versus a really large one. If you want to be an expert in the stock market nowadays, you're competing against Warren Buffett and big experts like that. If you want to be an expert on penny stocks, amazingly, there's like 100 people trying to be the experts on penny stocks. So you'd have to narrow it down to healthcare penny stocks to have it be a small enough sandbox where you could realistically be one to three relatively quickly. And the trick is to find a sandbox so valuable, you'll do anything it takes to become the leader in that. That's what we're doing with How to Start a Family Office, Into Millionaires, Billionaires. Those are all different sandboxes we're competing in over time. And once you get momentum in one, you learn about how you got momentum in one, and then you have that credibility to get momentum in the next sandbox that you want to go after and really be the leader in. And so people who don't take the work to become an authority are not very confident about what sandbox they're trying to dominate. And then ironically, the more long-term focused you are, and you just do things that nobody in their right mind would do, like you, Ruben, interviewing 240 people on this podcast, that takes a ton of work and a really long-term mindset. People don't want to do all that work. But you did it. And a lot of people don't even get started on such a thing because they're not confident in where they're going and that it's going to be worth it. But the more that you do things like you're doing, Ruben, or like I'm doing with our thought leadership that you would not do in your right mind unless you were focused on the 10, 15 year result, then that's when you actually get faster results because people now trust you and see you as a relative expert and they, oh, okay, well, this person's really in it and they know their stuff and they would not have spoken at 200 events in 15 countries on family offices or whatever it is, you know?
I would say one thing is if you're afraid to do it, thought leadership does not necessarily mean that you have to be the one that's providing the thoughts. In my early days, it was all about highlighting the guest, right? So they were the authority. I was just the reporter asking questions, kind of like, hey, you know, tell me about capital raising. How do you do it for limited partners? How do you do it for co-GPs? Tell me about fund structures. And those guys, after listening to them over and over and over, they started to drill some things into the back of my brain. And now I'm able to confidently speak about it. But in the beginning, you don't have to know anything. All you have to do is be curious of mind. Even if you are introverted, you don't have to be the one that has to be outgoing. All you have to do is, well, I would say, you know, drink a little coffee or get a little energy going before you ask these guys questions just so that you're funny. But they are the ones that provide the authority. So before we go into branding, Andy, do you have any questions? Go ahead, brother.
Yeah, so let me ask you. So you've spent a lot of time in the last 2 years, and I think this is kind of, again, goes to the evolution of your businesses where now I got to figure out for these multimillionaires and billionaires, how do I save them money, right? Because more of it's about wealth preservation at this point. So three or four maybe tax hacks, because you've talked about, hey, I'm not an expert, or I'm not a CPA, but I do know kind of enough to be able to maybe lead somebody in the right direction. So I think this is a huge, huge value add for capital raisers in general to be able to be that kind of advisor and consultant. So maybe you can give a couple that would help us as a group, you know, to maybe consider and look at. Maybe there's just some resources even.
Sure. So one is that in addition to structuring a deal so that when a normal deal doesn't have collateral, we just simply ask for collateral, something that helps on structuring the deal. But related to investment, if you're investing into a piece of real estate or a company, and all you care about is doubling your money and getting a little equity kicker or getting a great result where you're unlikely to lose your money, and you don't really care too much of whether you're buying their equipment or buying their real estate asset or buying their operating business, then in some cases you can carve out and buy their equipment and have it be 100% bonus depreciation. And now you get a negative K-1 for what you invested that first year. I mean, you may still be able to get that equity kicker and still be able to double your money in the investment, just as if you invested in the company or the real estate. A lot of people know through different membership classes, you could have someone get a debt investment while other people are getting the equity investment. Then that way the people getting the equity get an increased bonus depreciation on a cost segregation study. That would be one tax strategy area. And then a really overlooked area is R&D tax credits for operating businesses. A lot of people qualify for those and don't realize that they do if they're in software development or manufacturing. And that can be a lot of found money. And then the other thing is that we help a lot of families structure things before they have an exit. And then that helps them protect their assets from getting taxed as much and help them just plan out, okay, how much of my money do I want stuck in a qualified opportunity zone for a decade? And then what am I going to do with the rest of my investments? And just helping them navigate that path as they go in a creative way is really important. The last thing I'd say on that is that first decade to run our investor club, I didn't pay a lot of attention to tax efficiency, but it turns out the only people that care about tax efficiency are the ones who make all the money. So most of your investors do care. And the other thing is that investment structures are almost more important than the strategy. If you give me a boring strategy and you let me structure it however I want to, then you can get all the income, all the protection, all the collateral, all the tax benefits, et cetera. And if you take a really great deal, but then it's structured poorly, then you know it could be a horrible deal for you. So it's just super critical to go deep on structuring and really become an expert on that.
Good stuff. Thank you.
Cool. Let's talk about branding and marketing. Is it the same thing? Tell me, you know, because I had my mentor, Annie Dickerson, who's raised, I think, over $100 million. And distributed $25 million in returns already in her, just, you know, 4-year career. She's blown up. But she says, you know, and she's the chief branding officer of Good Egg Investments. She says that your brand is one of the most important, if not the most important assets you can create. Can you tell us about building a brand and what you need to do or what you need to think about?
Yeah, for sure. So classic brand building that some people think of is doing radio commercials and TV and getting your brand out there. I'm not of that mindset. I was mentored by Eben Pagan and Joe Polish and Gary Halbert and Jay Abraham and Dan Kennedy, Dan Sullivan. And it's about, I think of branding as getting the customer in here instead of getting your brand out there. And so by chance, I've got this picture, I guess it's on this side, that my daughter drew on this wall behind me. You can see this little yellow ring there. And the brand should stand out from the competition and people know what you do and why they should work with you just because of your brand. Just like your podcast show is not called The Rubin Show. It's called Capital Raiser Show, right? I like that about how you positioned everything. We once changed from Family Office Club to Wilson Conferences and people dropped off. They want to be part of the Family Office Club, not Wilson Conferences. So you want to position yourself above others in a very unique, focused way. And then the difference of marketing and branding is the marketing is really, how do you build a funnel that brings people to your branding over and over again, so they come into your funnel and come in through different doorways of downloading a book on capitalraising.com or familyoffices.com or billionaires.com. And these are different doorways into your brand. So I would just encourage people to start out simple and not make your life too complex. We have complexity built into our system, but that's because we've been doing it for a decade and a half. And oftentimes people go too broad and they're like, oh, I don't want to turn people away. I can't only raise capital from lawyers for my litigation hedge fund. or whatever it may be, but you're not turning anyone away if you have not yet had a lot of success and momentum. Then you want to niche down and focus on delivering a ton of value to a very specific group and have a very specific position.
Okay, so I have this thing in my phone. It's called an intention statement that I revisit. It's got a lot of my goals and the reasons why I want to track my goals in there. You have something very similar. I don't know what you call it, but essentially it's a goals document that you look at every day. And selfishly, I want to know, because I want to duplicate something very much like this, break down what is on there and what are the sections that you specifically have. And do you recommend that people listening on this call create something like this?
Yes, I think this is the most valuable thing that I could communicate here today. It's more important, your capital raising, your mental health, your marriage, your everything. So lots of people know what they need to do and they just don't do it. And so what I have here, which I had right in front of me, it's always on my desk. It's always with me when I travel. It's laminated where I shave every day. And I read it every single day, including this morning. What I have is my monthly goals, my quarterly goals, my annual goals. And then these are one-liner statements that I need to always be operating by. It's like an operating system. And if I just could remember the best lessons from a book that I read from a billionaire just by reading four words, then I'll be like, oh yeah, I need to do that. I need to act more like that. And we all know what prescriptions we need to prescribe for ourselves. It's actually doing them that's the hard part. And so by reading this every day, this becomes like a lens through which I see the world. And then by reading this, I know that's not important. That's not important. This is what's important. And this is really important. And that's why I had great clarity as soon as I met you, Ruben, that I really would like to work together, because I don't take meetings. Like one of my one-liners is I don't take meetings I don't want to take. I don't do anything that's not exciting to me. And I do nothing that's linear, only exponential. And I've got a bunch of one-liners on here that I read. For example, hurry and stress is no longer part of my life. The most simple and elegant model, the better. Do not tolerate problems and raise my standard of excellence. I've got a bunch of statements like that, like 40 of them. And so every day reading this helps you stay on top of your monthly, your annual, and your quarterly goals. And it helps you act in the way you know you need to act to be the best version of yourself. And so whatever your goals are in life, you got to keep them top of mind, or other people are going to put their agenda in your brain, and your email inbox is going to make you go sideways every day based on other people's goals and agendas.
Okay, so before we start talking about raising from family offices and the difference of raising from them versus LPs or co-GPs or preferred equity or any other number of sources of capital, including funds and institutions, Andy, I'm going to let you ask one more question before we dive into family offices.
Yeah, I want to hit on that. So for your, so that's your individual goals, right? Now you've got your team and you've got 25 people, all of them with their own individual goals. How are you running your business now? Are you spending most of your time on content? Are you spending time on management? Because when you hear 25 people that you're managing, it sounds, you know, it sounds almost impossible. Obviously you've got, you know, lieutenants and, you know, COOs, et cetera. So how you're getting there, those goals seem to me to be more content oriented and building the business rather than kind of executing the day-to-day stuff.
Sure. Well, I'll just be transparent with it. I mean, my number one goal here is probably a little bit hard to read, and I'll be embarrassed if you can actually read the whole thing. But the number one goal is about my family and my wife and my health. If that's not in order, nothing else on this sheet matters. That's one thing. It's not just all about content. You know, I have a goal to get down to 179 pounds, to talk to my sisters once a week, to be the best dad possible, to have a date night once a week, et cetera. And I'm working on proactive health care for myself, not just reactive. So I have goals for myself and my family that are more important than anything else on the page. And that's why they're at the top. And then the other goals are really pretty macro. There's not a ton of goals on here related to content. There's probably 4 to 6 words on here related to creating content out of all these words. And so when I look at my monthly goals, I have my number one priority, which is family, self, and health. And then I have goals related to investorresidences.com, the Airbnb platform, and deals that we're closing there, negotiating, or big investors. I have my deal dashboard, and this is my tracking of all different deals that we're negotiating over a long number of years. It took us 12 years to acquire billionaires.com and over 120 email follow-ups to get it done. And 2 months ago, we acquired the largest social media asset in dentistry with 375,000 members. It took us 13 months to negotiate that deal and over 60 email follow-ups. And so a lot of this stuff is just tracking deals on the deal dashboard, what stage it's at, who's the partner, what needs to move forward, because we're sourcing deals for ourselves as well as our investors. And so a lot of my brain is focused on either hiring amazing people for the team, or it's negotiating deals, structuring deals, and developing relationships with family offices who want to start their family office or formalize it. And we just try to add a ton of value to them and then work with them to place their capital into things that we're doing or, you know, transactions that they're seeking. So I hope that answers your question, but not a ton of my time is spent on creating the content in terms of my monthly goals. But I was in Sedona for a couple's retreat with my wife, and I did record 5 videos while I was there. And I got up and at sunrise, I recorded some videos on the deck, just providing value and basically saying, this is what I've learned while setting up a family office, or this is what I've learned while getting $83 million of deals done in the last year. So you can see, these are not highly produced videos. This is what one looks like.
Founder of the Family Office Club. We've hosted 185 live events. We have over 1,000 members who are raising capital.
You know, the audio is not perfect. There's a bird chirping in the background. I don't have a video crew with me, but I just try to knock out 3 to 5 videos when I travel somewhere interesting, just so it's engaging.
Yeah, that's something everybody can do. Everybody on this call. Yeah, go ahead, Ruben. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing.
Brilliant.
That.
All right. So what's the difference between raising capital from family offices when you compare that to raising from retail limited partners or co-GPs or other sources of equity?
Sure. Yeah. Big difference typically is that when you deal with a high net worth investor, you're typically at least starting with people that already know you or in your local community, and they may only see 3 to 10 investment opportunities per year, sometimes only a couple. And so they don't have much to compare yours against, and they may be investing very small amounts. When you're going to someone who is a stranger, so they don't have as much trust and they see a lot more deals, they not only have more to choose from, they naturally become more and more picky on their criteria and what they're going to spend time on. And so you have to be much, much more dialed in to what all of your competitors are doing and stand out from them. Saying that you have the best in class or that you're unique doesn't mean anything when the family office looks at materials and it looks like everybody else that's doing value add multifamily that they hear from 4 times a day. It has to truly be compelling and unique compared to the ocean of people in self-storage or multifamily or long short hedge funds, whatever it is you're doing. So that's super critical. But the reward is that if you can win in that game, you'll be even better at raising capital from high net worth. And an $8 million check is the same as 80 $100,000 checks. One of our members raised a $40 million check from our community. That's equal to 400 $100,000 checks. So you can spend 400 times as much time to get the same amount of capital raised. Of course, the terms can be slightly different when somebody's uber sophisticated, but it's like 200 times more productive. It just takes patience and planting seeds and adding value first.
So how do you even find a family office or start creating relationships with them?
Well, they're all around you. I'll give you some clear practical answers. But when I moved to Phoenix, I saw a retail business that had a subscription model. I said, oh, that's interesting. I looked at their website while I was still at their store for the first time. Found that they had 19 locations and said, oh, that's even more interesting. Then I reached out to the owner via LinkedIn that day. And it was my first week moving here. And turns out it was him and his brother running the business. They had just sold to Goldman Sachs for $130 million. They were starting another platform somewhere else. And I got them to reply to me the same day cold by saying, I bet you are opening a new location with investors fairly often, and you're being diluted each time you do. I have an investment structure so you don't get diluted at all, and you can bring in all the capital you need to keep growing. Do you want to have a 10-minute cup of coffee? And it was just a one sentence reach out, and I got a response right away because it was something that was in their self-interest and was hitting them between the eyes with an issue they were facing. But you also, you know, you meet ultra wealthy families by, you know, living in Scottsdale or living on the island to Key Biscayne like I used to. So they're all around you, and there's a couple hundred family offices right in your neighborhood or your local area. You meet them by going to family office club conferences, of course, or going to places where they congregate. But the number one thing to remember is that if you're approaching somebody, to do it in a way that's going to add value to them and keep them in mind. So we're connecting 4 different $100 million net worth families. Their sons are taking over the family office, and we're connecting all 4 of those families to each other. That doesn't profit us or benefit us in any way, except for we're adding a lot of value to these families and these sons trying to figure out which way is up and how to manage their dad's expectations and not mess things up for their whole family, you know?
Very good stuff. Let's open it up for questions. Anybody got something they want to, or even comments on any of these topics for Richard? Take yourself off mute and ask away, or put it in the chat.
Well, while people are putting in the chat, Richard, I want to ask you, so you mentioned in your goals video that I saw about the resources that you're reading now, all billionaire related white papers, et cetera. Anything that you could share with us as far as some of the stuff that you really felt like we might get some, you know, we might get some wisdom out of.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Steve Schwarzman has a book called What It Takes. And I've read probably 25 or 30 billionaire books. And What It Takes by Steve Schwarzman is on Audible. And it's an amazing book. I love it. I'm reading it through for the second time. So I definitely recommend checking that out. I've read Mark Cuban's book twice. The founders of Home Depot have a book as well. I'd have to look up what the name of that one is, but I definitely enjoyed reading that one as well. And one thing that took away from that book that I'll never forget is that at the beginning, everybody laughed at them when they said they want to build 1,000 stores at Home Depot when they were launching their first store. But from the very beginning, they had the mindset of launching 1,000 stores. And so they wanted to build things right from the beginning with that in mind. And they had that intent from the very beginning. It wasn't an accident that they have 1,700 stores today. So that was one insight. And I think that what's interesting to me is that there are, I don't know how many millions of videos on YouTube. I read something like 80 years of video gets uploaded every minute or something to YouTube. And there's so many business books out there, but why stream business insights from anybody but billionaires until you've absorbed all of those, right? I mean, like, why take business advice from anyone else except for the winners in capitalism is kind of one thought I had. And so that's been kind of the journey that we've been on. And so even if we can't get an exclusive interview with Jay-Z or Michael Jordan at this point, or some of the names would love to eventually, we find public talks where they've given a graduation ceremony talk or a conference talk or at a nonprofit, and we put that video on billionaires.com so that people can stream those insights kind of on tap at any point. So that website doesn't make us any money, I mean, besides building new relationships, but it's one of the things I'm most passionate about, because sometime in the next 15 years, it's gonna pay off, I think, you know?
That's awesome.
At least with one good idea, nothing else, you know?
Peggy's got a question. She's got her hand up. Anybody else put your hand up too?
Well, I don't actually have a question. I've been with Richard for about 5 or 6 years now, and he does a lot of capital raising courses, and he gives you all these little tidbits you could do. They're just minor things, you might say. And if you put them in place, you really get, it really works. It really works. And the follow-up, of course, most people don't follow up, unfortunately, but the money's in the follow-up. So, I mean, every time Richard's got something that's available for you to do a capital raising conference, join him. He will give you these great ideas. And if you implement them, you will be highly successful. So awesome. Thank you, Richard.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll send you that $100 on PayPal. I promise for saying that, Peggy.
Yeah, Peggy doesn't say
I recognize Peggy as soon as I saw her on here. I recognize Gunter. I think Rob and I have met somewhere before. There's a couple other names here I recognize. And one thing is that I'm not competing against you guys. We invest into medical practices that are already profitable with multiple locations. We invest into Airbnb value add assets with our Airbnb fund called investorresidences.com. And we run an investor club. I guarantee you, nobody listening to this podcast episode has those three things. And if you do, I'd love to talk to you, so we can probably co-GP or joint venture or do something together, and we can collaborate versus competing. We just introduced a $1 billion balance sheet partner this morning to an Airbnb fund that we may co-invest with. And some would see that as funding my competition, but we don't, because we're going to learn by being part of that other Airbnb fund's, you know, trajectory, right? So we just have that type of a mindset. I definitely appreciate you mentioning that, Peggy. We just try to give, Joe Polish has a book that says life gives to the giver and takes from the taker, is like a quote he has. And he has a book about that as well. And I definitely believe in that kind of mindset. It all comes around over time. Cool. And yeah, the follow-up also is super critical. We have a $150 million net worth family we're helping set up a family office for. And it took us 38 emails and 2 phone calls and Zooms over a period of 2 years to get him to engage. But we did so in a polite value add manner, inviting him to our next event coming up, et cetera. And now he's engaging because the timing is right. So that's what it takes sometimes.
Okay, Mahad, feel free to ask away.
Okay, hey, Richard. I wanted to ask about family office groups. And do the family office groups that you work with, do they require years of experience, or do they mainly focus on just the value that you can provide them?
Primary focus is on the value you provide them, but the terms will be different based on your experience and your track record and how much skin in the game you have. So one group I know that has a $1 billion balance sheet, known the founder of the company for 12 years, he found somebody that had a systematic contract in place to develop healthcare centers for a client. and the client would sign the lease for the healthcare center before it's built, but they need somebody to build it. And so this person came with a relationship. They didn't have the ability to manage contractors or do ground up development, but they brought this to the $1 billion balance sheet partner, and they not only funded it, but managed the construction and gave them a piece of the deal for at least finding the opportunity. So their participation is much less than if they had the ability to construct it, build it, manage the whole thing, and all they needed was money. But sometimes early on, you need more than money to make sure the deal goes well and assure the counterparty that it's going to go well. In other cases, people have some progress. And so by somebody providing all the capital and overseeing some of the construction or management or operations, they'll take like 50% of the upside, but bring all of the capital to the table and help bring in the LPs, but be kind of a co-GP manager. So it just depends on the situation, but it just has to be really unique from what everyone else is saying, or they're just going to kind of glaze over and not engage in the first place, you know?
Gunta, do you have a question before we turn it over to Irish Kevin? Go ahead, Gunta.
Hey, I just want to say I met Richard many years ago, and there's one thing I would like to add to this conversation is really building relationships and face-to-face meetings. And what I learned from Richard many years ago, you need to meet the person at least 7 times before you and build a strong relationship, a friendly relationship without pushing, then you really get a good check.
That's great commentary right there.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Great to see you here, Gunter.
Irish, my man.
What's happening, guys? Woo! A little chilly up here.
I bet.
On the shark pool. Great event. Thanks for putting it on. Thanks, Richard. My question for me, I know you've been in the business for a long time, so you obviously have a big database of investors, right? So how often do you review that database, and like, how do you know like who's like staying active and maybe what type of assets that might be best for? And if you have any like dead wood after a while, do you just like kick them out of the database and not even deal with them? So I'm trying to figure out how you spend your time like managing that database that you've built.
Yeah, sure. So deadwood, we don't kick out unless they're just from countries where we just tend to never transact with investors. And if they're in countries where we just don't really make much progress, we'll sometimes remove them from our database. We do use HubSpot to manage things. You know, other good options would be like ActiveCampaign is a decent option to consider. You can see who's clicking on links, who's engaging, et cetera. But we also rank our investors based on whether they're 1 million plus net worth. I think we have 10 million plus net worth or 100 million plus net worth. We also rank them based on whether they need help starting a family office or there's some other relevant way of working with them. And then also on their level of engagement, not just their dollar value net worth, but also is it a 1, 2, or 3, a 1 being very engaged, a 2 very lightly engaged, but we think there's potential there, and 3 being not engaged. And then my head of investor relations can be working that list, updating the CRM every day. And her job is to touch base via text message, email, and phone call with 50 investors per day to be planting those seeds and developing those relationships. And then the ones who want to start a family office or could write bigger checks or are ready to move forward, she hands over to me to try to bring them home and do something with them or invite them to the events to meet with us and meet our team, et cetera.
I know like you have probably like a broad range of investors, but do you actually have like a so-called avatar that you concentrate on, or is it just all like high net worth individuals? And
yeah, great question. So we have kind of a barbell approach. On a very high end, we like $1 billion balance sheet companies or publicly traded entities or billionaires. And we try to interview the billionaires on billionaires.com, but we've closed 22 transactions for $1 billion plus groups to date. And we want to not just serve the 4 we're serving now. Our goal is to build that stable to 10 billion-dollar plus partners so we can say we've closed 100 deals and have the rewards of doing that. So that's at the far end. The other far end is dentists and doctors. We love working with them. They're nice people. We get along with them naturally. They're easy to work with. And we like investing into medical practices, both medical and dental. And so when we talk to a doctor about investing in somebody else's medical practice, it's a pretty easy, straightforward conversation. And everybody wants real estate so they can invest into our Airbnb fund. So both conversations are very easy and natural. And that's high volume. The $1 billion balance sheet groups, very low volume. And then the middle is really just other investors who approach us. We invite them to our events. We'll work with them. It's just not a target group unless there's someone starting a family office. And then we've got a book, of course, called How to Start a Family Office. And we've got a free dashboard for them, and we help set up their family office, hire a better wealth advisor, hook them up with service providers. And we do all that for free just to know their direct investment strike zone. And then we'll bring things that hit that buy box. But we do all the work up free while our competition charges $50,000 to $250,000 to set up a family office. We don't need their short-term fees. We just want to win with them long-term. So everything is structured for the long-term. In the medical practices, we have equity for when they sell one day. And in the Airbnb fund, we don't make a dollar of profits or collect any asset management fees until our investors get all their money back and then double their money. And once they get a 2x return, that's when we benefit. And so that's important to understanding where we focus our energy.
Very good stuff. Thanks. Hey, so thank you, Irish. Wakefield's got a question, but before we do that, I'd love to get a selfie. So if anybody wants to get on there, please turn your cameras on and start waving here. And I'm going to go ahead and pop this picture.
Kate Trevor's getting his hair ready. I love it.
All right. I'm going to go ahead in 3, 2. Actually, hold on. Let me make sure that. All right. 3, 2, 1. Boom. Awesome. Excellent, guys. All right, so last question of the day, Wakefield. Let us know what you have for Richard Wilson.
Yeah, hey, Richard. Thanks so much for sharing all this information. Really valuable. I had a question for family offices. So for you, it sounds like you guys maybe started to target family offices right off the bat, or sometimes it's a little bit harder when you're starting off. You don't have the track record. Would you start with a retail investor, build up your track record, and move to family office, or just say, hey, let's go straight for family offices, and this is my avatar?
Sure. Some people cheat the system and don't do what I'm about to say. And if you can pull it off, more power to you, and you just become enormous quickly. We try to make that happen for people sometimes if we get to know them well enough. But I've known a few people that just go straight to a family office partner, really unique custom structure, and they grow to several $100 million in just 2 or 3 years. Hard to do. I wouldn't bet the bank on that. I would put 80% of your energy into smaller investors to begin with, and then 5 to 20% into bigger investors. I would only go to bigger investors who are in the city you live in, or the city where you're buying assets, or a city you visit all the time and can get to in a 1 or 2 hour flight or car drives, that you could go there often and develop a real relationship and not have friction of raising capital from somebody in Singapore and you're based in Miami or something. And then I would look at your background. Most people get into real estate, especially, because it's probably at least half real estate people here, I'm betting. They came from being a dentist, a doctor, a surgeon, a lawyer, a business owner, a chiropractor, an engineer, something. And is there a niche? Is there a space in the world you came from to raise capital? If you came from manufacturing, you might think, oh, what am I going to do? Raise capital from my old manufacturing floor employees? But in every industry, there's an industry association where people are paying $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year to be a member. And those are the owners of businesses in that niche. And if you went to the owners of manufacturing companies or partners of law firms, there are the top 1,000 that are making a lot of money in the niche. And if you came from that world, you can talk to them like a manufacturing insider or like an attorney and navigate that better than anyone else that's listening to this podcast right now. And so I would go to family offices in the ultra wealthy that are local to you or local to your brain and where you're from, and then just navigate from there to move forward, because those who understand your industry already or are local to the assets are going to move forward the fastest. And it doesn't matter if they have a formalized family office or not. If they're worth $10, $20, $30, $40 million, who cares if they have a formal family office? They can write the check you need to look for. Maybe don't aim for billionaires first. Maybe don't aim for 100 million. Aim for people worth 10 to 30 million and try to raise those $250,000, $500,000 checks instead of 50K or 100K.
I got it. Thanks so much.
Fantastic stuff. Any last words that you want to say for the aspiring capital raiser, Richard or Andy?
I would just say that integrity is the thing that gives you the most power. Integrating the food you eat, where you live, who you hang out with, what media you consume, what goals you have, and that you actually read your goals, the team members you hire, all those things. The more aligned they are, the faster you go, and people just help you go faster because they see you're going somewhere and you're going there quickly with 1.2 million downloads, and people just want to help you get to 3.2 million downloads, right? So The more you have friction, the more that your life is not fun because your executive assistant sucks and you're not healthy, you don't feel good, and you don't like where you live, and then it's just problems everywhere.
Yeah, one thing, Ruben, just for everybody in this room, Ruben started off with 0 downloads, and he just kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And now his partner is Richard C. Wilson, who basically has billionaires in his network. And I just think it's pretty awesome how quickly these things can grow. They always start slower than you think, and then it's faster than you think, right? So great stuff, Richard, man. I really appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, that was awesome. Fantastic.
Yeah, no problem. We're happy to help anyone here who has a question, always happy to help, reply to a text, reply to an email, get back to you as soon as I physically can, just to be helpful. And that's what our whole brand is about, just like Ruben, just trying to help people before they spend a dollar with us, so they know that we're genuine and authentic, trying to be helpful.
Cool, guys. And go to the Super Summit. It's got 150 billionaires or something ridiculous like that. Or they've all raised at least $100 million, right? Is that what it is?
We have one event a year where everybody's raised $100 million plus. This one, we have 150 speakers on stage in 3 days and more family offices on stage than any other event globally. And it's right in Fort Lauderdale on the beach in mid-December. So for most of you, that'd be a nice relief from the cold weather you're already feeling there.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a blast, man. I look forward to catching up with you and writing a book very soon. With that, we're going to let you go, brother. Thank you so much, man. Really appreciate your partnership and your friendship, my friend.
Legacy Acquisitions.